This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, February 6th, 1987, new rules are in effect that impact almost a million employees in almost 7,000 buildings used by the General Services Administration. That is to say, federally owned and operated buildings. And these new rules state that federal employees can no longer smoke cigarettes freely, but now only in designated areas. This could be all sorts of spaces, we'll get into it, but you know, this couch is for smoking, this smoking room, maybe you're picturing those little painted boxes out on the sidewalk designated for smoking. This is basically the moment where we start to get those for federal workers. And of course, this is a moment that is part of a larger story and larger trend to curb smoking in all sorts of ways, sort of peaking in the late 1980s and 90s. So let's talk about this moment, that larger context, and look, we're talking about a controversial federal mandate intended to improve the health of federal workers and those that interact with them, with all sorts of unintended legal and cultural ripple effects. I can't imagine this has any resonance for stuff we're talking about today. But here to discuss, our special guest for this episode, Sarah Mylove, professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of the book, the perfect title for this conversation, The Cigarette, A Political History. Sarah, thank you for doing this.
Such a pleasure to be here, Jody.
And we were all gushing over the cover of your book, which is phenomenal. And then you told us it won an award for, what did you call it? A Dusty?
I made that up. Okay. It's called a Dusty. It did win an award, so please judge my book by its cover.
There you go. It is a wonderful cover. It looks like a Marlboro cigarette box, right?
It does.
But also, if you were to open that book and read the words on the pages, it's also quite good as well. here, as always, are also Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello.
Hello, Jody. If I had just one tweak, Sarah, to the title of your book, how about The Cigarette, An Esoteric Political History?
Second edition, Nikki.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm actually fine with the cover of your book. I think it's sexy. Yeah. And hey there.
So, Sarah, I mean, you know, I want to talk about this moment itself, but just put it in context for us. How notable is this specific moment that we're talking about here, this federal mandate, in that larger history that you know so well?
I'm going to do the historian thing and say that it is significant, but also reflects changes that were already afoot.
Yeah.
Some of those changes are spurred by new scientific evidence regarding the harms of what we now call secondhand smoke. The year before the GSA issues its regulations, the Surgeon General authors a report on secondhand smoke, but that report in and of itself was already the culmination of years of accumulating scientific evidence around secondhand smoke. But if we look back further into the past, into the history of the anti-tobacco movement in the 20th century, by 1987, there is already a well-established non-smokers' rights movement that's already making claims to control public space on behalf of non-smokers. So the GSA regs are kind of cresting this rising wave.
This is such a fascinating moment, like a tipping point, because it does seem, from watching Mad Men and also being a historian, like in the mid-20th century, smokers were ascendant, right? That smokers' rights were just, that were naturalized, right? And the idea that you were a non-smoker didn't have much cultural cachet. But by the time we get to the 1980s, there is an entire federal government who's saying, actually, there's something not great about this. And if you are a smoker, you're now going to start to be huddled off into designated areas, where I think before it was non-smokers who had to go off into designated areas.
Yeah, there's so much there. First, you know, thinking back onto, you know, the haze of tobacco smoke that is the 20th century, think about Mad Men. I think that because we associate, you know, the tobacco industry with such power, big tobacco as the ultimate big bad lobby, there might be a tendency for us to overstate the number of smokers. Hmm. Even at the smokiest point of mid-century, smokers were still a numerical minority, right? Mm. Even in the smokiest point of the 1950s, less than half of all men smoked, an even smaller number of women. And of course, you know, some kids smoked, but, you know, not. Sadly for the tobacco industry, more kids did not smoke. Non-smokers had always been in the majority. But Nikki, what you identified is it was not until the 1970s that non-smokers took on the mantle of a rights-based movement where they sort of self-consciously asserted themselves as a constituency, changing the kind of social default.
That's so fascinating to me because I think about really in this moment how smoking gets segregated, how you see all of these spaces that sort of become like the smoking section, which some of it's kind of weird because early on it's not really that segregated. Like if you're in a restaurant, you're gonna get that smoke whether you're on the right side or the left side or whatever it is. But the idea of seeing people smoking outside of a building was something that I think is definitely new because it was always still allowed indoors.
Yeah, you know, it's beginning in the early 1970s, the amount of space, physical space that smokers can take up, and that smoke can take up because you try to constrict the smokers right. In order to restrict the smoke, begins to contract. And the first place you see it contracting is also as a result of federal rules, buses and airplanes. Those are the first areas where smokers and non-smokers are segregated. Now, we can think today, the smoking section of a bus or the non-smoking section of a bus still had a ton of smoke, but that represented an improvement. And actually, the GSA in 1974 issued its first smoking regulations that basically already started to cordon off space to separate smokers and non-smokers in recognition of the fact that non-smokers did not want to be around smoke, which, you know, is not what we would accept today, but at the time represented an important step in the evolution of shared space.
You hinted at it, but how much was that about the science of secondhand smoke? I mean, you know, obviously, this is where there's a big resonance for today, but this idea that your personal choice doesn't just affect you, but it affects the other people around you who share your air with you.
This is such an important point, and I think one that might be kind of counterintuitive to us today. So in the early 1970s, there was basically a social movement led by suburban women that argued for restriction of smoking, not based on science. That hard scientific evidence about the harms of secondhand smoke did not emerge until the early 1980s. But what these women were essentially arguing was, we deserve to be in public. We have a right to take our kids to the library, out to eat, without having to worry about children or non-smokers developing a tobacco allergy or feeling uncomfortable. But it was not in the language of the science of the harms of secondhand smoke. It was kind of a civic entitlement to share public space for, you know, the middle class birthright of going out to dinner, right? Uh-huh. And so these groups start to spring up in the early 1970s. 70s are a great era for acronyms. And so this group is called GASP, Group Against Smoking Pollution.
Okay.
And these GASP chapters proliferate all over the country, and they end up securing some of the first local anti-smoking ordinances in the 70s, you know, well in advance of the GSA. So the GSA is building on the groundwork that's already been laid by a decade of non-smoking activism.
You know, that reminds me so much of this activism that was happening in the 19-teens and the 1920s about smokestacks. And obviously a very different kind of putting smoke in the air, but it started off as a woman's movement where the arguments were a mix of aesthetics, of cleanliness, and it's only in the 1920s that it becomes this more scientific language, this more kind of data-driven argument against smokestacks. So it's interesting to see that replicated in the 60s and 70s.
Well, it's not just replicated. It's also in the 1920s, there was an early anti-smoking movement. There was an early tobacco prohibition movement, also led by women, through the language of vice.
Wow.
That's also at the same time taken up by industrialists like Henry Ford, Edison, that argue for efficiency reasons to restrict smoking. So it's not just that there's an echo, it's actually related to the history of the anti-tobacco movement in the United States.
This idea that it might be efficient and pro-business does help solve a question that I had, which was about, you don't necessarily think of the Reagan administration as one that is putting new regulations on businesses and on people for things like smoking. So if it's seen as a pro-business thing in the 1980s, that would make it feel more right for the Reagan era.
Yeah, the business case for non-smokers' rights has such an interesting history. So in the history of the non-smokers' rights movement, you have this woman-led social movement that establishes anti-tobacco ordinances and sometimes secures voluntary compliance at restaurants through the 70s. Then beginning in the mid-1970s, you have the emergence of a non-smokers' rights movement at work. And this happens through a court case led by a woman named Donna Shemp, who has a horrible tobacco allergy. She's a customer service representative in New Jersey. Everybody smokes at her office. She has to wear a gas mask to work. She can't get relief by going to management. She can't get relief by going to her union. So she decides to sue her employer, a little mom and pop operation known as Bell Telephone.
There is a Ma Bell.
Yeah, Ma, exactly. And Donna Shemp prevails in her court case. The judge says that New Jersey Bell has a common law obligation to provide Donna Shemp a safe and healthy work environment. Mm-hmm. And Donna Shemp basically becomes what we would today call a workplace consultant. And she still works at Bell after she wins her case, but she has kind of an after-hours career as somebody who advocates for more smoking restrictions at work. And the argument that she makes is that smokers are bad workers, that they take too many breaks, that they destroy equipment, that they steal from the company through theft of time, that they're expensive to insure. And the case for smoking restrictions at works as it develops through the late 70s through the 80s really centers around cost arguments. There's articles in publications like Management World and Personnel Today, you know, about how easy it would be for managers to save money by simply banning smoking at work.
Wow. Wow. I think of like the level of shame that also goes into smokers as well, in which it's so funny. I remember living in the Pacific Northwest and I hardly ever saw smokers, like never. And then when I moved to Boston, I kind of got culture shock because I'm like in Cambridge outside of Harvard and everyone's smoking and I'm like, what world is this? Like, but it felt like one, smoking was more of an urban thing, but it also felt like smoking was a thing that was like, ooh, that's the bad thing that you do and you're a bad person. Like there's this whole like negative narrative that goes around the smoker as the outsider because they are literally outside.
Well, like, yeah, that's the
out of the building.
That's the thing about this moment that I was thinking about shame as well. It's like, what is the how much of that is part of this, either intended or not, of just like, oh yeah, you can smoke, but go stand in this stupid little box that's painted onto the ground outside the building, or go into this room, you know, off in the corner or whatever. Is stigma and shame like an intended part of this, or how much does it become?
I think it was certainly an stigma and shame is a public health tool.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's one that it should always be used, but it was certainly one that non-smokers understood the power of. Perhaps in contrast to parallels today, is that smokers themselves felt shame. It has always been true that most smokers did not want to be smokers. That was true in the 1980s. That was true in the 1960s. It was hard to quit. And so when work made smoking more difficult, it did help some people to quit, but it also perhaps reinforced to those who could not just how aberrant they were. But I think it's also in this era that smoking becomes a fully classed phenomenon.
Yeah.
And that's quite a contrast to, you know, the smoky world of Mad Men. Yeah. In the smoky world of Mad Men, it's doctors and lawyers, executives, all walks of life are smokers. That changes by the 1980s. And in part, some of the change is driven by the techniques wielded by the non-smokers' rights movement.
I take your point about shame and the shame that even smokers feel. But there isn't there also a dynamic? I mean, I know a bunch of people who smoke who talk about, you know, the power of the smoke break and that you get to know your office workers when you step outside for a cigarette, or a cigarette is a really great way to just, you know, you're at a bar or at a whatever and you pull out a cigarette, you all of a sudden start talking to a stranger, and that can either be a social lubricant, or maybe if you're in a work environment, it could be the way you bond with a coworker or a boss, or move up
or decompress.
Yeah,
that's such a great point about the cultural meaning of smoking, and in fact, as you allude to, the power of quote unquote stealing from your employer. It's not a productive activity. It's something that you do on your own time, which is why in the 70s and 80s, actually through the 2000s, one of the most interesting dynamics is you get labor unions advocating against workplace smoking restrictions, in part for precisely the reasons that you identify, that it is the prerogative of a worker, that such workplace smoking restrictions, which after all come from management, the GSA is management to federal employees, that this subverts collective bargaining. That it might be that the smoking status of a worker might become a metric to exclude the employment of certain workers into the future. So you get labor unions advocating against workplace smoking restrictions, and you have management advocating for them, which I think goes back to Nikki's point about, you know, why is it in the Reagan era? Why in the conservative 1980s do you see the proliferation of workplace smoking restrictions?
It's so funny. I mean, yeah, the smoke break is where you go and you talk shit about your bosses and you realize that you're both getting underpaid and, you know, maybe you should join a union or something. It's amazing. Yeah.
It's a consciousness raising smoke break.
It's subversive. But I do want to be clear on another point. There are, I guess you could say, like legitimate labor-based reasons for unions to have opposed workplace smoking restrictions. But the tobacco industry was also astroturfing this. They were also orchestrating letter writing campaigns against the GSA rules, and in fact succeeded in weakening the GSA rules through these letter writing campaigns in 1987.
Wow. As we wrap up, can you just, we were talking about this a little bit before we started taping, but you know, can you just paint a little picture of like some of the absurdity of the attempts to cordon off smoking? I mean, we mentioned the little thing that gets drawn on the sidewalk. In the intro, I think I read somewhere, you know, that there was like, oh, this couch is for smoking or whatever. I mean, what are some of the other examples you've come across?
On an airline, sitting next to somebody that if you're just across the partition, you would effectively be sitting next to the smoking section as a non-smoker. Smoke wafting everywhere. Sitting in the non-smoking section of a restaurant, you're still smelling the smoke everywhere.
I just vaguely remember, I haven't been in an airport, it feels like, in a while. Certainly not Atlanta's airport. But one thing I remembered about Atlanta's airport was that they had this glassed off partitioned room in which people could go smoke. And every time the door opened, just this waft of smoke would come through. And I always remember that the walls were kind of like this grimy yellow. It's kind of gross. Kind of sad.
It does feel like airlines and airplanes are, interestingly, like where some of the last vestiges of these smoking areas are. It's always so funny to me to be on a plane now and to see the no smoking light go on. And it's such a vestige of an earlier age, because I think for those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s, the idea that you could smoke on a plane is unfathomable. And so the fact that they have to tell people not to smoke on a plane, you're just like, what? Why would anyone think to smoke on a plane in the first place?
No, Nikki, it's more recent. It's more recent than you think. Yes, it was not until 1988 that smoking was banned on short flights, 2 hours or less. And it wasn't until 1990 that it was longer flights. And that's just domestic. You know, the rules governing foreign travel are, you know, at the discretion of foreign airlines. And so I think it's entirely possible that people, you know, witnessed smoking, perhaps not on an American flight, but into the 2000s.
That's so interesting.
Wow. I
just have other questions for you about smoking and smoking history that don't have anything to do with the GSA. But one is, have there ever been any spaces in our civic life that have never had smoking in it?
Could people smoke in church? In synagogue?
Oh, I don't know about I've never thought about churches, but okay, anything Mormon.
Okay.
Anything Mormon, no smoking.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly, the earliest workplaces to establish across-the-board smoking bans, grimly, was the Johns Manville asbestos mining operations in the 1970s. And this gets back to the union point. And that was because Johns Manville didn't want smoking employees because they were even more likely to develop severe asbestosis. Mm. And therefore, Johns Manville could be on the hook for even more tort claims. So, you know, it wasn't out of health. It was out of, you know, liability concerns.
We're only going to damage your lungs one way.
Yeah, I'm sure there's, you know, Jody, to your question, I think there's examples that have to do with flammables.
Right.
Probably dye works, you know, places where smoking is just too dangerous to do on the job because you're going to explode. Right.
My mind went to gas stations.
Yeah, I know. Just about to say gas stations.
But you see those videos on Reddit every once in a while of someone just like smoking a cigarette, I guess. And obviously, if they have to put a sign there that says, to remind you that you shouldn't smoke, it's for a reason. So, yeah. We were talking about drinking on this show of some liquor laws recently, and you know, we got into a little bit of a conversation about how drinking has become less and less prominent in certain circles of American life, but that over the pandemic, I think a lot of people drank their way through the pandemic. Do you have any evidence or any sense of whether people started to smoke their way through the pandemic over these last couple of years?
Only that New York Times article that suggested that people are smoking more, but it was, you know, just like one of these.
Yeah.
New cultural trend articles. They interviewed like four people standing outside a bar in Brooklyn and said, you know, everything's gone to hell, so why not live for the moment kind of thing. I don't know of studies that show that smoking. These studies exist. I don't know of them. They, obviously, people are studying this, but this is not my expertise necessarily what's going on right now.
And I mean, tell me if this is still not your expertise, but you know, are there spaces that now where smoking is still kind of at the levels it has been historically, or has it dropped off in the way that we've seen, as Kelly was saying, you know, in so many cities and so forth?
I know, because I think regionally, maybe that's just me, but it seemed like no one smokes in the Pacific Northwest. Now, that's not true, but like it definitely felt like an anomaly to see someone, because it's such REI land and people are hiking and camping and all. You would not see, you know, a smoker, but, or it would definitely be something that was out of step.
So, yeah, I think that, overall, national smoking rates are much lower than they have been since the early 20th century. I want to say it's under 15%. But those are, you know, variegated by region, as Kelly has observed. It's greater in the South and it's greater in rural areas. Now, relating to the subject of today's show, you know, OSHA does not regulate indoor smoking.
Hmm.
Indoor smoking is regulated by cities and states. And so there's no place that was as smoky as 1985.
Right.
But there are places even in Charlottesville where you can smoke indoors. Like there's a bar called, you know, Horseshoe Flats or whatever, and it says
I've been there.
Yeah, smoking permitted, which is, you know, insane. And that has to do with the fact that it's local laws govern smoking. There are some states that have, you know, entire clean indoor air acts where basically no smoking is permitted at any workplaces. But Virginia is not one of those states. And so localities are empowered to regulate smoking as they wish to.
So I can imagine that makes you think a lot about some of the other conversations we're having now about health mandates and how it's, you know, federal versus local and so forth. So we ask this basically of every historian, but this feels particularly apropos of your work. I mean, you know, how have you been watching this vaccine mandate and these other health mandates related to the COVID crisis play out with regards to your expertise?
All I can think is that the United States was lucky to have arrived at a position on smoking when it did, in an era that was less partisan, where there were truly rock-ribbed Republicans who led the non-smokers' rights movement, where religious people were active in the non-smokers' rights movement, and that was, you know, also for religious reasons, you know, Mormons don't smoke. There were a lot of anti-smoking activists came from the West. And at the same time, there were liberal Democrats who led the non-smokers' rights movement. So it was important that this issue cut across political affiliation, because I grimly think that if the smoking issue were still a live one today, we would be living in a world with smoky air and more guns if people were asked to put out their cigarette.
Fascinating.
Mm.
Wow.
Wow. I know. This was so good. I think about the fact that I think my kids will have no idea what an ashtray is. Like all of the relics, I guess you would call them, of smoking. There's no context.
Or that like a car had a, like a ashtray on every single,
Or that doodad, the lighter doodad.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, what is this? Although,
yeah, it'll be interesting if with the marijuana legalization, if they'll be more used to seeing people snuffing out a joint or using vape pens.
And yeah, of course, we didn't talk about vaping at all, but obviously that's a huge dynamic, I'm sure, now as well in all this. All right. Well, listeners, if we have not convinced you that there's more beyond just a great cover to Sarah's work, I don't know what we could do, because this has been fascinating. This is incredible. So, Sarah, my love, thank you so much for doing this. And again, the book is called The Cigarette, A Political History.
Thank you.
And Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
Kelly Carter-Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Wait, Sarah, as we go into the credits here, any particular, we sometimes play a clip at the end of the show, any particular cigarette ad or crazy moment or clip that comes to mind that we should play for listeners?
There's this really funny interview, but I don't know, it might be like too random, where a tobacco executive is in an interview and he claims that some women prefer low birth weight babies.
Wow. All right. We'll try and find that.
Oh my gosh. That's like, you just appalled me.
Have they been proved to be safe, Mr. Coleman?
I believe they have not been proved to be unsafe. It's true. The babies born from women who smoke are smaller, but they're just as healthy as the babies born from women who do not smoke.
What about the higher rate?
And some women would prefer having smaller babies.
Radiotopia.